Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Last summer, Dr. Bethany Wattles, a clinical pharmacist in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Louisville School of Medicine, was here on Eastern Standard to talk about a statewide effort to try to encourage less use of antibiotics. The concern is that germs are quickly growing less and less resistant to antibiotics, and Kentucky has the highest rate of antibiotic use in the entire country. It's especially high in eastern Kentucky, where in some areas, children are receiving three times more antibiotic prescriptions than the national average. And now, many companies that have been developing new versions of the drugs are losing money and going out of business. So we invited Dr. Wattles to come back to tell us how this is impacting efforts to contain the spread of deadly drug-resistant bacteria. Thanks for being here, Dr. Wattles.
Thanks for having me.
So first, just tell us what you're seeing going on here in Kentucky with regard to all this.
Yeah, well, and really it's a national problem with the pharmaceutical industry. Currently, the way that all drug reimbursement works is that it's tied to volume. And antibiotics are used for a short period of time. You know, you take an antibiotic for a week or two to treat an infection, as opposed to other medications such as cardiovascular drugs, blood pressure medications that might be taken for a lifetime. And so it's just an unfortunate situation for pharmaceutical companies that they're looking to make money. And so their time and efforts are better spent on medications that are going to result in a larger return on investment as opposed to antibiotics. And then because of the problems with drug resistance that you already touched on, when we do have new antibiotics to the market, we have to reserve those for worst case scenarios when there's really nothing left to treat the patient with but these new medications. We kind of have to savor those new ones that we do have come to market.
So I reached out to you to come back after I spotted an article about all this in the New York Times, and I'm going to read a passage and then get your thoughts about it. Here's what it says. Antibiotic startups like Akeogen and Aradigm have gone belly up in recent months. Pharmaceutical behemoths like Novartis and Allergan have abandoned the sector, and many of the remaining American antibiotic companies are teetering toward insolvency. One of the biggest developers of antibiotics, Melinta Therapeutics, recently warned regulators that it's running out of cash. And the article goes on to say, experts say the grim financial outlook for the few companies still committed to antibiotic research is driving away investors and threatening to strangle the development of new life-saving drugs at a time when they are urgently needed. So I'm just wondering, these drugs are truly saving lives. Is it as dire as it sounds?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that we need to be concerned about. And essentially, we need to fix the problem now before it's too late. Because the process of drug discovery and development and approval can take over 10 years. And so we need to make sure that we're investing in supporting these important research and discovery areas before it's too late. You know, here in Kentucky, we can kind of relate it to the development of bourbon. We know that that takes 2 years, even much longer for a good bourbon. And so we have to kind of anticipate what our needs are going to be in the future and get started on that research and development now so that we still have drugs to turn towards decades from now.
So this must be really throwing curveballs at you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in the hospital, we have to think about what we still have, using what we have that's going to treat the patient. But also in healthcare settings, we have the pressure of not using too high of cost of medications as well. So if an old drug is still going to work, we're going to use that. And we kind of we're familiar with it. We know how to use it. And then we're going to save the newer drugs for kind of when they're absolutely necessary. But of course, that paints a difficult picture for the drug companies that need to make money off of the new medication that they've put a lot of money into for development.
So on the one hand, we're rightfully encouraging doctors not to overprescribe to kind of rein in their prescription of antibiotics. But on the other hand, that's limiting the ability of these companies to recoup their investments and discover compounds and win regulatory approval. It would seem to be quite a difficult tension going on there.
It is, yeah. And so I think truly what we need to do is figure out a way to change reimbursement for antibiotics specifically. Just this model that we have of reimbursement purely based on volume is not going to be sustainable for the future, so that we still have antibiotics come 20, 30 years from now.
Do you think this situation shines a spotlight on the hundreds of millions of dollars it takes to market a drug and do additional clinical studies?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why it's kind of a tricky time right now. So we hear a lot about needing to decrease drug prices, that it's too expensive for the healthcare industry and for patients. But for antibiotics, it's kind of the opposite. We need to make sure that the pharmaceutical industry is making enough money that they can sustain research and discovery of new antibiotics. And so it's a challenging time that I think we just need to educate policymakers on the differences and the importance of antibiotics. But there are some efforts in place to make things easier for the development of antibiotics. Like back in 2012, there was a new law passed that would increase the length of market exclusivity for new antibiotics. So making that the discovery process and then the approval process after that point, then the pharmaceutical companies that are investing in antibiotics are able to maintain that exclusivity for a little bit longer in order to make back the money that they put into development. We're also seeing some national funding to support the early development and phase one process of drug discovery. And so that's going to kind of incentivize different companies to develop antibiotics so that they're not abandoning those programs. But we still have to think about later on in the process, once the drugs are approved, if they're still not getting enough reimbursement, it's still going to be a problem down the road. And that's kind of what we're seeing with Acagen and some of the other startup companies that are still having struggles.
I mean, we're talking about superbugs here, things like MRSA, for example, that are becoming resistant to just about everything we have to throw at them. And the prospect that without effective antibiotics, many common medical procedures could become life-threatening, actually, would seem to be a bona fide major crisis. Do you think Congress needs to see it that way and respond to it on that level?
Absolutely. It's a huge public health threat that we need to recognize and make moves towards fighting this problem. So it's often referred to as the post-antibiotic era, kind of similar to the pre-antibiotic era, where people were dying from very simple infections. And now we need to keep in mind that that could happen again if we don't have effective antibiotics. Any type of surgery would be a huge risk because you could develop infection that would be untreatable, or just common simple infections like a scraped knee getting infected. You know, we might not have anything to treat that in the future. So we need to recognize the depth of this problem and make sure that we're making efforts to fight it.
Do you think part of the problem might be political sensitivity about soaring prescription drug prices? Everybody's pushing back on that right now. Resistance to supporting any legislation that provides financial incentives to drug companies?
Yeah, that kind of touched on that a minute ago, but we do just need to make sure that, I think that's a responsibility us healthcare providers need to take on, that we're educating the policymakers and making sure that they understand the difference between antibiotic development and that cost and the dire need, as opposed to just high drug prices in general on chronic medications, like I mentioned. I mean, we need to make sure that patients have their insulin and can afford that monthly. But we also need to make sure that if a hospitalized patient has a difficult-to-treat infection, that they have an antibiotic that's going to treat it.
Well, bringing this back home to Kentucky, what's your message to Kentuckians who hear about this situation and want to do something about it?
Antimicrobial resistance in general is a very scary concept, and it's something that we need to come at from multiple angles. And so it's also important, while we look to Congress and those types of initiatives to change the antibiotic discovery process, we also need to make sure that we're safeguarding the antibiotics that we currently have and only use them when absolutely necessary so that they'll be effective in the future.
Dr. Bethany Waddles, a clinical pharmacist in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Louisville School of Medicine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As serious as this sounds, the antibiotic versus superbug situation is not hopeless. NPR's Richard Harris has talked with some people engaged in finding solutions.
Andrew Reed at Penn State University argues there must be a better way to fight these superbugs other than engaging in an endless arms race with them.
Most people are looking for new drugs or new drug targets or rapid diagnostics, that sort of thing, and all that is important work. But the heart of the problem is the evolutionary process that generates the resistance.
And few scientists are focusing on that most basic problem to find out-of-the-box solutions. He is an exception. One idea, since bacteria are more likely to evolve resistance if they are exposed to antibiotics for a long time, why not try limiting the dose, at least for people with healthy immune systems?
Oftentimes, in many situations, the immune system kicks in and it kills the bugs and clears them out. So all the drugs need to do is buy the immune system a little time. So that's the most obvious situation where we don't need the drugs to finish off every last bug. We just need the drugs to make us healthy again and let our immune systems take care of us.
Another idea is to hit germs with several drugs at once, the way tuberculosis is treated.
Psychologically, it's a bit scary putting all of your firepower into one regimen. On the other hand, it can work very effectively at preventing the evolution of resistance. And so instead of just using drug A and that fails, and then drug B and that fails, and then drug C, using A, B, and C all together can stop any of them failing.
Another evolutionary biologist working in this area is Heinrich Schulenburg in Kiel, Germany.
One idea that we are particularly interested in is sequential therapy.
That is, giving different antibiotics in rapid sequence, say switching every 12 or 24 hours, so the environment for the germ is always changing.
And we know from evolutionary theory that this makes it very difficult to any organism to adapt fast to these conditions.
He's tested that idea successfully in petri dishes and is now gearing up to test the concept in humans.
The point that we as evolutionary biologists want to make is that whatever kind of treatment we design, we need to take into account how bacteria evolve.
Sheila Connolly is VP of research at a small company called Synthetic Biologics in Maryland. They're developing a counterintuitive drug, an enzyme that actually destroys common antibiotics like penicillin. The idea is to give these anti-antibiotic pills to people who are getting the antibiotics injected directly into the bloodstream.
And our enzyme stays in the gut, and it's not absorbed into the blood, so it doesn't affect antibiotic efficacy.
But it does destroy antibiotics in the gut, and that's where they are most likely to trigger drug resistance.
So if we can avoid the gut being exposed to antibiotics, then we prevent the evolution and emergence of antibiotic resistance.
Preliminary findings from people suggest that it works, and it also reduces the risk that people will develop a potentially deadly infection called C. difficile, which is triggered by antibiotics in the gut. Industry spokesman Greg Frank agrees there is a role for novel approaches.
I do think that there can be some creative ways to buy us time. I am firmly of the opinion, though, that we will almost certainly never outthink bacteria with our current arsenal. We'll always need to be developing new medicines.
So he and his associates are lobbying Congress to pass a bill that will pay companies to keep innovating, even if their products end up largely sitting in reserve, waiting for the day when they are needed most. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Still ahead after a quick break, the 2020 census gets underway soon, and Danny Rogers is here to assure you that the information you provide is strictly confidential.
We're sworn, we have a lifetime oath that we take to not disclose any of that information, that personal identifying information, under the penalty of $250,000, which I don't have, and 5 years in prison, which I'm too cute for.
Plus, the Midwives of Appalachia and a Kentucky filmmaker's documentary makes PBS. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Why is it so important to take part in the 2020 census? Danny Rogers is a Census Bureau partnership specialist for Central Kentucky. Her job is to get out there and develop relationships with local public officials and civic groups to build community awareness about the census. They formed complete count committees in many counties to get this done. Thank you for coming in, Danny.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Danny, tell us what you do for the Census Bureau.
Okay, my title is Partnership Specialist, and what that means is I speak to state and local government officials, community leaders, community members, and raise awareness about the census. I let people know what is true about the census, what is mythical about the census, so that people can be as educated as possible when they are participating in the census. We really want to make sure that those who tend to have scams maybe around the same time that the census comes out, that people can differentiate between what's real and what's not when it comes to what it is that we're doing. Because we're around every 10 years, that's ample opportunity for people to try to come up with different ways to trick people into providing money or information that we would never ask. Like, we'd never ask about Social Security number. We will never ask about maiden names. We will never ask you for donations or your party affiliation for political reasons. We won't ask any of those types of questions. And so if you come across a census scam that does ask those questions, you'll know it's not us.
Danny, I understand that this is not your primary focus, but I know that the area census office in Lexington is responsible for completing the count of everybody in the eastern half of Kentucky. That's about 77 counties. It's a pretty huge area and a huge task. Can you tell us whether or not there's a need for more workers to help get that job done? Are you hiring?
Absolutely. We are hiring, and we want people to know that the jobs are absolutely going to be available in all of those counties. It's nationwide that we're doing this, but specifically here in Kentucky and the counties that we're covering here out of the Area Census Office from Lexington, which is those 77 counties that you mentioned, we want to make sure we have a surplus of applicants because as we start calling people for these jobs, we know that some people may no longer be available. We know that some people may say, you know what, now that I think about it, it's not for me. We want to make sure that we still have enough people to complete this count. And we'd rather have people who are coming from a lot of those hard to count communities who live there versus having somebody that we fly in from another state just to help us get that count. It's much easier to have your neighbor come knocking on your door to get those 9 questions answered than to have a stranger come by your door.
And these are not volunteer jobs. These are paid jobs.
Oh, they're very well paid. In Fayette County, specifically, it's $19 an hour, 58 cents a mile reimbursement, weekly pay. And we have full-time jobs available, part-time jobs available, and flexible hours. So if you needed something in between 20 hours and 6 hours or something like that, you could do that. So you can work around school schedules. It's great for students. You can work around daycare schedules if you're working around school for your children or daycare or something like that. If you're retired, you can do that. I actually had a full-time job in 2010 and did this on my way home. And it was an amazing experience for me.
And you also provide training for
absolutely. And you get paid for the training.
Wow.
So, yes, we don't cut any corners when it comes to that. We really want people to take part in this civic duty. We want people to be proud of the work that they're doing, and we want people to be well compensated for the work that they're doing.
Well, let's talk about that civic duty and why it's really important for everyone to at least participate in the census survey itself, if not get involved. What's at stake?
So there are over $675 billion, billion with a B, dollars given out every single year by the federal government, and they typically go to government assistance programs. You have your WIC, you have housing programs that use that money, education programs, Head Start, transportation. If you don't like potholes, guess what? That census information is going to make sure that your roads are smooth. So that money gets distributed to all of the different states based off of the population. The numbers that we get for 2020 are going to be the numbers that are used for us in our budgeting for the next 10 years. So it's extremely important that we get that information as accurate as possible. We want everybody's participation because those resources come from that $675 billion.
Last summer, the Supreme Court blocked the Trump administration's move to include citizenship questions on the 2020 census form, saying the administration's rationale for including the question seemed contrived. Can you tell us how census professionals felt about this? Were there concerns, had the ruling gone another way, how people would respond to the census?
Well, I can't speak directly to those proceedings and the outcome. What I do know is that it is mandated by the Constitution for us to count everyone living in the United States. That's the specification, everyone living in the United States. And that's the part that we focus on. We want everyone, regardless of that status, to be counted. If you are a non-English speaker, if you are somebody who lives here 6 months out of the year, we want to make sure that you get counted because, again, those resources go to the state that you reside in. And we want to make sure that every state, every community, every city gets what is due them.
And we are required by law to respond to the census. In other words, it's against the law to refuse.
We want to make sure that people understand that if you have the opportunity to do the census, what it's going to do for your community, the focus of it is the impact that it's going to have on the things that you actually care about, all the programming that you enjoy for your children. For example, I have dogs, so I have a hard time talking about children because I really don't know what people do with kids. I'm a great aunt, though. But we want to make sure that the children have adequate lunches, for example. If you care about those things, I want to impress upon people that it impacts your life, your day-to-day. You may not think that it does. You may think, oh, it's just counting people every 10 years. Yes and no. What it is it's making sure that all of the things that matter to you, the medical professionals are paid, that hospitals are properly staffed, that they have the proper programming, that all of those things are available to you when you need them based off of the number of people who actually live here.
Last year, our guests included David Prince. He's a Lawrence County teacher who's a member of the Complete Count Committee in his community. And he told us all about it then, but it's been a while, and many listening today may not have heard that interview back then. So if you could refresh us, what is a Complete Count Committee?
A Complete Count Committee is a collection of people. It can be on a state level, local government level, or community level that come together and say, you know what, we know our demographic better than anybody else. Danny, it's great that you came in to talk to us, but, you know, you don't know our city, our neighborhood like we do. And because we know it best, we would like for you to come in, train us on some of the things that we can do to best get this information out to our community, but we are going to come up with the strategy. And that's what happens. I come in, I train them, they develop their own strategy based off of what they know their community needs, and then they implement that strategy to raise awareness leading up to the census and going through the census.
We're all going to get the census form in the mail, correct?
Yes. So starting March 12th, there's a very new thing that's happening for 2020. It's available online for the very first time. You have the opportunity to self-respond by mail, by phone, and by the internet. And so if you choose to do that, starting March 12th, we'll send out a passcode to each household that's been identified through address canvassing back from August through October of last year. And you'll get a passcode specifically for your address. And we want you to fill it out for everybody under the roof. It doesn't mean just your family. If there are six families in the same household, we don't care. We just want to make sure that everybody under that roof gets counted. And so based off of that passcode to that address, we want you to fill that out. 9 questions. That's all there are. There are more questions. Of course, you may have to repeat a couple of questions if there are 2 or 3 extra people, but that's all we ask. And so you will get that by mail from March 12th through the end of April. You'll have 5 reminders to be able to go online, do it by phone, or do it by mail. But the thing is, by the end of April, we'll assume that maybe we still haven't reached you, and that's the reason why you haven't responded. And so that's why we will then start going door to door to try to get those households that didn't respond already to answer those questions face to face. And that's why we need those help with doing that.
I heard something there that we probably ought to underscore, and that is that you may be renting your house and the landlord restricts the occupancy, let's say, to 6 people, and you got 10 or 12.
Right.
You're not going to get in trouble
Not at
all.
Your
landlord is not going to be told that you have additional people under your roof.
Absolutely not. Some of the confidentiality that goes with the census are the fact that none of the information that we collect of those 9 questions, none of that can be used by law enforcement in any way. It can't be used by Homeland Security, can't be used by ICE, it can't be used by your landlord. We won't tell them. We're sworn, we have a lifetime oath that we take to not disclose any of that information, that personal identifying information, under the penalty of $250,000, which I don't have, and 5 years in prison, which I'm too cute for. And so because of that, we are not going to tell anybody. Your information is private for 72 years. So that was implemented back in 1978. So for 72 years, which they considered your lifetime, nobody's going to be able to see your name, your address. It's not like those old ledgers from before that if you're on like one of those genealogy websites that you can see where your name and address was there. You won't be seeing any of that for 72 years by law. Title 13 keeps that protected.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So how many questions are there on a form?
There are 9 questions. And so I say 9 questions with an asterisk, meaning that if it's just you, 9 questions. That's all there are. Beyond that, if there are 2 or 3 other people, however many other people there are in the household, you'll may have to repeat a couple of those 9 questions, but they're still in the same vein of questioning.
And then how long will you have to get it done and respond?
So because we start sending it out March 12th, whenever you receive your passcode, immediately you can go online, you can call, you can do it by paper and fill that out. And we want to do that all the way through. We're hoping through summer we'll have everything wrapped up. So hopefully by July, you'll have had the opportunity to self-respond. People will have come to your door and asked those questions, and everything will be wrapped up hopefully by July.
I understand that in April, census takers start visiting college students and those who live on campus, people living in senior centers, and others who are living among large groups of people. Tell us about that effort.
So that's the group quarters enumeration, and what that is actually starts in February, because we want to make sure that we get people before April comes around, because if they're on college campuses, a lot of them are going to be gone by April. So we start February 3rd through March 6th. We do what the group quarters. We go to those senior living facilities, different jails. I'm not trying to equate the two, but residence halls. We hit the colleges and the universities starting February 3rd. They'll be getting letters from our operations side of the census, and they'll be working in conjunction with the administration there in charge of housing, just to make sure that they can get that accurate count. So if you're on campus and you're living in one of the residence halls, you probably won't touch any kind of paper, because they'll take care of that between the operations and the administration with the housing. If you live off campus and you attend college or university, then you will be getting something, because that's considered a household, and you'll be able to fill it out not only for yourself, but if you have roommates. So again, it's not restricted to just you who gets it. Tag, you're it. If you get it for you and all of your roommates, then you have to fill it out for everybody. But we do that early so that we can catch those students, because a lot of times they're in some of those renter occupied homes, and we want to get them before they leave for spring break.
Well, Danny, you seem to really enjoy this work. What about it is it that you so enjoy?
What I love about it, honestly, is being able to educate people where I feel like there have been some missed opportunities before. I'm from a couple of marginalized communities, and I know how things can be very much inequitable. And I want to make sure that everybody understands just how important it is, the impact that it actually has on people's communities. I come from a community where sometimes there's a lot of distrust about from the government, from law enforcement, from a number of different entities. And historically, it's not necessarily been the safest thing, but I'm here to express that it is safe now. And again, if for those who have fear, for those who are a bit skittish about doing anything that has to do with the government, the beauty of it is you can do it without anybody ever having to come to your door. You can do it online in 4 minutes if you speak different languages. It's available in 12 languages. So the way that you can do it online, by phone and by mail, 12 languages available. Outside of that, there are 59 languages where you can have guides to try to help you get through that. But it's in no way exhaustive, especially here in Lexington. We have, 185 languages represented here mm-hmm. in Lexington. And so we want to make sure those other languages that aren't represented within the group of 59 languages, that we have people who are willing to help their communities be able to fill those things out so that they understand, too. And I do understand. I'm sensitive to the fact that in some countries where we may have some refugees or otherwise immigrants who are here, that maybe the census was used for genocide. Mm-hmm. So we have to be able to explain that this is what the census is for us, and this is how safe your information is. This is how we use it to help you and your community. If you want more documents translated into your language, we have to know that you exist as a community. If you want more medical professionals who speak your language, we have to know that there are people who speak that language here. I just want to make sure that everybody knows as much as possible, from the highest position in the state to whatever position is your day-to-day person. We want to make sure that everybody has equitable access to that information.
Danny Rogers is a Census Bureau Partnership Specialist for Central Kentucky. Thanks so much, Danny.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You know, their mothers had been midwives, or neighbors had been midwives, and they watched and were drawn in to help.
Women's voices, like that of Mary Duncan, a public health nurse in Pulaski, Wayne, and McCreary counties in the early half of the last century, are often overlooked by recorded history. Fortunately for Dr. Courtney Kissot, Mary was among the women interviewed for the Kentucky Historical Society's Rural Healthcare Oral History Project. In her work as an associate professor of history at Southeast Missouri State University in Cape Girardeau, Dr. Kissot has drawn on such oral histories to publish an article about a movement nearly a century ago that introduced birth control in eastern Kentucky. Her article, completely sold on birth control, rural extension work of the Kentucky Birth Control League, 1933 through 1942, has been published in the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, and you can find it on the Facts and Information page on our site, esweku.com. Thanks for joining us, Courtney.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
Why have you chosen to study the history of rural women?
I believe that I have become interested in this history because I am a rural woman myself. I come from a town of about 6,000 people in southern Illinois, and I have noticed firsthand that our stories are often diminished or neglected altogether, both currently and in the historical record. So my work aims to rectify some of that neglect.
And so you have focused on the work 1930s into the early 40s of the Kentucky Birth Control League. Give us some of the highlights among the materials that you discovered in the archives of the Historical Society.
Well, the Kentucky Historical Society holds many archival collections of interest to a scholar of rural women's history such as myself. They hold all the records of the Kentucky Birth Control League, as you said, or KBCL, as I'll refer to it. They were the 15th state affiliate of the American Birth Control League. So their collections include correspondence, records, scrapbooks, and those are all very helpful to my research. They also have a wonderful collection of oral histories. One that's especially useful is the Rural Healthcare Collection. And then they have many collections relevant to rural social work in the early part of the 20th century, just to list a few examples.
Okay, and again, the period that you're looking at, 1930s into the early 40s, when 1930 arrived, the 19th Amendment had existed for only a decade, and with that then very recent empowerment of women to vote in mind, what social conditions would you say the family planning movement had to encounter back then?
Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to break my answer up into kind of two parts.
Of course.
Here, and so I'm so glad you mentioned the suffrage movement, because that was such a hallmark in women's history. And what historians have found is that there's really a continuous line of reform from abolition to temperance to suffrage to other social reform movements that we see throughout the 20th century. And so rather than just like be satisfied with the vote, we see those same women going ahead and reforming to continue to try to improve society. So I think that's interesting how it's like a continuation. And some of the social conditions that the KBCL faced when they began their work in 1933 was just some really tough conditions. I mean, it was the beginning of the Great Depression, or the worst part of the Great Depression. So unemployment rates nationally are at 25%. They're even higher in some places in Kentucky. And then the bad economic conditions of the Great Depression were compounded by natural disasters like drought and floods and falling farm prices. All of these things hit rural families especially hard. And as you know, Kentucky has always been a state with a high rural population. So in 1930, almost 70% of Kentucky residents lived in rural areas. So that was these were all some conditions that the KBCL faced. And then for rural women especially, their lives are really characterized by marriage at a very young age, many, many children, lack of access to modern health care, and a reliance on folk medicine and customs that sometimes were fine and sometimes did not save the life of the mother or the baby.
Tell us what you learned about midwives in the Eastern Coalfields.
The term midwife, we know, has come to mean different things to different people over time. So today, when we think of midwives, we think of trained nurse midwives who have undergone medical training. In those days, a midwife could just mean an older neighbor. They were often called granny women. So just a neighbor who attended births because she was the most experienced person around, often a person with no formal education, perhaps not even literate. It's really interesting that in 1923, Mary Breckinridge, who went on to establish the Frontier Nursing Service, conducted a study on the granny midwives of Leslie, Owsley, and Knott counties. So she interviewed 53 of these granny midwives. She found that their average age was 60, and they had each had about 9 of their own children, but most had not even a couple years of schooling. And so this is what Breckinridge aimed to reform, was to introduce trained nurse midwives into Appalachia.
What forms of birth control were available in those days?
Well, then as now, a woman's access to contraception really depended on her socioeconomic status and her location. If you were an upper middle class woman living in a city, you probably didn't have to worry about it too much. You had a private family physician who could either prescribe you a diaphragm. That was the most common form of contraception. You could go buy condoms at the local drugstore. But then in the country, you have people relying more on traditional and folk methods like the rhythm method and withdrawal. And you also see a resurgence of the sterilization movement that's being promoted by eugenicists. So the idea of sterilizing the unfit so that they couldn't procreate. And then after 1938, there's another method called the foam and sponge method. It was developed by Clarence Gamble for use with rural women in North Carolina. But women complained that it was not a comfortable form of contraception for them, and they resisted using it. So the KBCL and the American Birth Control League promoted the diaphragm as the most effective form of birth control in the 1930s.
Was there official resistance to family planning back then?
Well, yes, there sure was. Reformers really wanted family planning services to be included in public health clinics. But the Kentucky State Board of Health actually blocked this initiative. They had established the Bureau of Maternal Health back in the early 1920s, and throughout the 1930s just pointed to that bureau as an acceptable solution to all matters involving women's health. And what's interesting is this made Kentucky somewhat of an anomaly among other southern states. North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, Florida, Mississippi, Georgia, and Virginia all added family planning to their public health services between 1937 and 1942. But in Kentucky, this didn't happen until 1962. So that was one form of official resistance at the state level. There was also national resistance emanating from the American Medical Association, and they wanted only trained physicians to be able to prescribe birth control. And historian James Reed has called this a medical monopoly on birth control. So kind of resistance from multiple fronts there.
You have noted that of all progressive reform movements, the one for birth control had the most potential to affect quality of life, yet it also drew the most fervent ire from the opposition. Are these issues still present today?
I mean, it seems pretty clear to me that these issues are still very relevant today because we as a society haven't been able to agree on whether all women should have ready access to contraception and what that would look like. And so for the arguments from those who oppose this access haven't really changed since the 1930s. People cite religious beliefs, a fear of promiscuity among unmarried women, a fear of destroying the American family, and a belief that it's just not the role of the government to provide health care. So it seems that opposition to contraception has grown more fierce, just as public support has increased.
Courtney, among the volumes of information that you poured through, there was a study of national data by the Guttmacher Institute. Tell us about that.
I sure will. The Guttmacher Institute is a nonprofit and nonpartisan research and policy organization that's committed to advancing sexual and reproductive health and rights. So in 2011, that's the last year for which national data are available, they found that 45% of all pregnancies in the U.S. were unintended, and that includes 3 out of 4 teen pregnancies. So our unintended pregnancy rate in the United States is much higher than in other developed countries. And so more than half of all women in the United States will experience an unintended pregnancy by the time they reach 45.
And according to that study, the Guttmacher study, 47% of all pregnancies here in Kentucky in 2010 were unintended. Now, the impact on individuals might seem obvious, but what about the public cost of unplanned pregnancy?
Yes, and thank you for pointing that out. That rate's even a little bit higher in Kentucky, and we know that economically disadvantaged women are disproportionately affected by unintended pregnancy, and that can mean a cost on public tax dollars. So in 2010, in Kentucky, the federal and state governments spent almost $380 million on unintended pregnancies. And that doesn't even factor in the cost to social services and any kind of care after that baby is born. So an unplanned pregnancy is just very expensive for the mother and for the government.
Now that you have digested, you processed all of this information, what's your perspective of access and education among rural American women today?
Well, I have found that education and access to rural health clinics are very important to rural women's health, but also that rural clinics are in danger of closing. So since 2010, over 100 rural hospitals throughout the nation have closed, including several in Kentucky. You might remember just last summer, the clinic in Pineville shut its doors after a lengthy fight. So every time a rural clinic closes, that denies access to all the women in that community who then have to travel farther to get services. And then the other component of that would be just education. So the KBCL made education a cornerstone of their program. I believe that it should still be a cornerstone of our efforts today to reduce unwanted pregnancies. And that when young women in high school or college learn about their different options, they are more likely to make the choices which are best for them at that time in their lives.
Dr. Courtney Cassatt, Associate Professor of History at Southeast Missouri State University, discussing her article, Completely Sold on Birth Control, Rural Extension Work of the Kentucky Birth Control League, 1933 through 1942. Thank you so much, Courtney.
Thank you so much, Tom.
George was the cripple. He got TB, which was a death sentence.
He was in the hospital 9 years.
He's the one that was not supposed to make it.
Alaskan native George Atla overcame adversity to become a sports legend.
Perennial favorite, many-time champion.
You have to be dedicated. You have to be out to win.
The last interviews with George Atla.
Native people all over Alaska would be cheering, "That's our man," you know.
Atla, part of Independent Lens on PBS.
And you know what's especially cool about that? The director of ATLA, Catherine Axley, is filmmaker in residence at the University of Kentucky. She was here in December to talk about her film supporting Rachel Grimes' folk opera, The Way Forth. At the time, she mentioned that she had a documentary in the works. We asked for a heads up when she's ready to roll it out, and she's ready, and she's here. Thanks for stopping by, Catherine.
Thanks, Tom.
So you're going to be screening and answering questions about your new documentary on February 12th, and we're going to have all those details in just a moment. But first, tell us how the story of George Atla came to your attention.
So I first went to Alaska with the intent of making a short film about language revitalization. I have a friend who's a state representative there, and I'd been following his work to introduce a bill to recognize Alaska Native languages as official languages of the state. And I was interested in the intersection between language revitalization and political power. But while there, I read an article about George and was immediately in awe. You know, here was this man who had dominated his sport for many decades, had won many championship racing titles, and in Alaska, he was considered a rock star. But at age 80, he was starting a new chapter of life. He had founded a program in his late son's name to introduce dog mushing to youth in his community of Huslia as a form of cultural revitalization. And though a youth dog mushing program and a champion dog musher don't seem to have that much in common with language revitalization, I soon learned that there were many parallels. And then once I read about George's childhood and about his life and how his racing career intersected with major economic and cultural shifts in Alaskan history, I knew I had to reach out. I was just surprised that a documentary had not yet been made about him.
And he became ill, correct?
So the most unexpected challenge we faced was that he did become quite ill. 2 months into filming, he had to be admitted to the ICU, and it was completely unexpected. And we found out soon thereafter that he had been suffering from bone cancer. And about 3 weeks later, he did pass away. So that was certainly the most challenging part of making this film from a personal perspective, from a filmmaking perspective. But the last time I saw him in the hospital, I promised that I would finish the film, you know, because it was really important to share his newfound passion of working with kids to pass on a cultural tradition to the next generation. So it became even more important to finish the film and share this with a wide audience. It was also important to me, you know, being there and being in this incredible landscape and seeing these dogs run, it was really important to visually capture that. And I'd been watching a fiction film that was made about George in 1979 that has these incredible helicopter aerial shots. And I just really wanted to capture that visual somehow. But, you know, I was a grad student on a grad student budget, and there was no way I was going to be able to rent a helicopter. So I have a twin brother who made it his project to learn how to operate a small drone. And he accompanied me on a couple of my shoots and was able to film Joe, George's grandnephew, who was racing during his races. And, you know, this is a way for the audience to see how vast and beautiful the interior Alaskan landscape is.
Well, Catherine, it's quite an accomplishment to have your work selected for broadcast on PBS, and I don't want to place you in the position of having to toot your own horn here. So instead, what I'm going to do is quote Shauna Swanson, who's the supervising producer at Independent Television Service, or ITVS, which is the main funding arm of PBS for independent documentary projects. And here's what she says. To get broadcast as a national strand such as Independent Lens is a long process. ITVS has about 300 applicants per public open call, and there are two of those each year. Only 8 to 10 projects are selected for production. In 2016, in a highly competitive field, ATLA was selected by an outside panel for funding. It is unusual for our first-time filmmakers to even get selected. Recently, ATLA was selected for broadcast on the PBS television series Independent Lens, and this is also a competitive process. The curators review hundreds of acquisitions and ITVS co-productions. Only 21 to 22 are selected for the season. And so first, congratulations for making the cut. That's huge. But also, what was it like to actually see your work being broadcast on PBS?
It was a great honor to see ATLA on PBS, and I think for those in the film, to see them watch themselves on TV for a national audience, that was what made it so worth it.
And it's probably available now on demand, correct?
It was available on streaming on PBS's website, but it's currently not available online. But we are working on making it available on another streaming service in the near future.
Okay, but in the meantime, if you do want to see it, there will be an opportunity, and that's coming up on February 12th. Tell us about that event.
Yes, I'm so excited that the University of Kentucky is going to be hosting a free screening that's open to the public of ATLA. It's on Wednesday, February 12th at 6:30 p.m., and it will be held in the James F. Hardiman Theater in the Davis Marksbury Building on campus, which is located at 329 Rose Street. So I encourage your listeners to come and join and spend 60 minutes in Alaska with us.
Catherine Axley is filmmaker in residence at the University of Kentucky and director of the documentary ATLA. Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks, Tom.
G Jim Gleason has stopped by Eastern Standard, guitar in hand. Many of you here at EKU may know Jim as Dr. Gleason. He's an associate professor of communications here at the university. Others may know Jim as a founding member of the Johnson Brothers, a longtime mainstay among Lexington bands and a regular feature of the city's Thursday Night Live series. He has a new album, and he's here to tell us about it and give us a sample. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
Well, thanks. Happy to be here.
And congratulations on your new album. It's titled Sure I'm Blue. I hope you're not.
No, not particularly, but I was, I guess, at the moment.
Well, tell us about this one. What makes it different from what you've done before? You know,
what's really different about it, I'm kind of a musical omnivore, I mean, as you know. I pretty much like a little of everything, and the records I've done in the past, the three previous ones, are really sort of almost a mixtape. They're a little bit of everything that I like. So they run between, you know, classic rock sort of things to blues to country to gypsy swing to a little bluegrass. So they're a little bit of everything. This one, I don't know if it was exactly a plan, but it sort of evolved into being something that was much more within one single idiom. It's pretty much all blues based. It's within those boundaries, it's you know, covers a number of different styles, but it's pretty much straight ahead blues based, and that's been something different for me.
And who else is on the album? Any other local musicians?
I've been really lucky to have some good friends help me with this. Dave Hammond has been somebody I've been working with. He's the drummer from Johnson Brothers, and he plays drums and keyboards on several tracks. And also Dr. Kevin Holm Hudson, who is the keyboard player from the Twiggenberries and also is a professor over at UK, and he plays piano and organ on several tracks.
Okay. You brought your guitar in with you, and we'd like to get you to play a couple of bars, a few bars from a tune off of the album, if you would.
That'd be great. Happy to.
When I don't love you and I don't need you, I feel the same since the day before I met you, but I'm happy just to be your friend. And I hope you'll be around with me till the bitter end.
All right, Jim, that was terrific. Thank you.
Thanks
for bringing that to us. What are your musical plans going forward, Jim?
I've been lucky enough to play with a number of different bands in town. I've been playing with Nick Stump every Thursday night. He's a great blues guy. He's been around for a long time in his band. There's some other bands I do sort of pick up stuff where we did the Pink Floyd show not too long ago with several other people from the UK. And my wife's band, The Bats, which I'd be remiss in not mentioning. So I'm lucky enough to play with a lot of really good people. And Lexington's a great town for that. I think people are sometimes surprised to know how many really extraordinary players there are in the Lexington area.
It's always amazing. All right, he's Jim Gleason. The album is Sure I'm Blue. Just Google that, and it will come right up on top there, and you can give it a listen. So thanks so much for coming in, Jim.
Oh, I've been delighted. Thanks very much.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.fm or esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.